Well, thanks for joining us today, everyone. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is excited to host today's webinar outlining the findings of the Union of Concerned Scientists report, Right for Retirement, the case for closing America's costliest coal plants. My name is Erin Cameron, and I will be the acting facilitator for today's webinar. We will be recording this webinar, so all of the lines have been muted to assure recording quality. We encourage you to type in any questions that you have using the questions option on your control panel. Your questions will then be answered at the end of the presentation today. For those of you not familiar with SAFE, we are a regional organization focused on promoting responsible energy choices that create global warming solutions and ensure clean, safe, and healthy communities throughout the Southeast. SAFE has been a leading voice for clean energy policy to protect the quality of life and treasured places in the Southeast since 1985. And I'd now like to turn the presentation over to Ula Reeve, SAFE's Regional Program Director.
Great. Thank you so much, Erin, and thank you, everyone, for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us today. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy has been working closely with the Union of Concerned Scientists over the last several months to prepare for the release of this important report, and we are pleased to finally be at a point where we can bring the findings and messages forward to share with all of you, our allies, to help strengthen our work to retire coal plants here in our region. This report offers a new lens through which we can view and discuss the financial feasibility of and opportunities for retiring coal plants in the region. 121 units at 61 plants across the Southeast are flagged in this report as being uneconomical for ongoing upgrades and retrofits as compared to the other possible energy resources. And probably not too surprisingly, Southern Company's fleet tops the list with the greatest number of necessary retirements. I hope you find this webinar and their new report insightful, thought-provoking, and very useful in your work to clean up our utilities' energy mixes. Please don't hesitate to follow up with me afterward if you want to dig deeper in or have questions. Please make sure to check out our blog and website feature about the report that we have published yesterday at cleanenergy.org. Without further ado, I am pleased to introduce our presenters today, two of the Right for Retirement report authors, Steve Klimmer and Rachel Cletus. We do also have report authors Jeff Diet and Steve Frankel on the line and available as we go into question and answer at the end. Steve Klimmer is Director of Energy Research in the UCS Climate and Energy Program, and he conducts research on the economic and environmental benefits of implementing renewable energy technologies and policies at the state and national levels. Before joining UCS, he was the Energy Policy Coordinator for the Wisconsin Energy Office. Steve holds a Master's of Science in Energy Analysis and Policy from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a BA in Political Science and History. Rachel Cletus is a Senior Economist with the Climate and Energy Program at UCS. Her expertise is in the design and economic evaluation of climate and energy policies at the state, federal, and international levels, as well as the analysis of the costs of climate change. I will now turn it over to Rachel.
Great. Thank you so much, Ula. And thank you all for joining us today for this webinar where we're presenting the findings of our new report that we released yesterday called Right for Retirement, the Case for Closing America's Costliest Coal Plants. As you're all aware, our power sector is in the midst of a pretty dramatic change right now. We're seeing a lot of old coal-fired power plants being retired, and natural gas and other cleaner resources like wind and efficiency stepping up to fill the mix. And this, in a sense, creates a historic opportunity for our transition to cleaner energy resources. It also is a very important decision point for regulators and utilities and planners who are thinking about the future of our electric system as they make decisions about costly retrofits of these old plants versus investing in other cleaner resources. So what we did in this report was essentially we examined the remaining coal fleet of our operational coal fleet, and we looked at it through an economic lens to see which additional coal generators might become uncompetitive once they installed certain important pollution controls relative to cleaner generation sources. And we use generator level and national data drawn primarily from SNL, EIA, and the EPA. And we use generator level data because, as you know, a single coal plant can consist of more than one generator, and each one can have a very different economic profile. So we felt it was important to do the analysis at that granular level. So I'm going to walk you through some context and our broad methodology, and then I'm going to switch it over to my colleague Steve Klemmer to do a deeper dive into our results. Just to start off, I wanted to share some of the context in which we did this analysis. So in this slide, it basically captures this dramatic shift in our electricity mix that I just described. You can see just going from 2008 to 2012, what this graph shows is we've gone from a reliance of coal of over 50% to under 40%, so down to 37% as of August 2012. And simultaneously, we've seen natural gas ramp up significantly, going from 18 to 30%. But wind has also picked up significantly. In fact, by the end of 2012, we expect that the installed wind capacity is going to be 60 gigawatts. Now, what's driving these changes? As we know, it's a combination of both market and policy factors, and there are things like low natural gas prices, the rising cost of coal, different pollution standards, as well as the falling cost of renewable energy. But we know that the state of our aging coal fleet is a significant driver of some of these shifts. And just to put some more detail on that, this is a graph that essentially describes the vintage of our fleet, and you can see that a good three-quarters of our fleet has exceeded the expected 30-year life expectancy that they had when they were built. And a good 17% of the coal fleet was actually brought online before 1962, so more than 50 years ago. And simultaneously, a factor that's highly correlated is many of these old plants don't have some basic pollution controls. In this case, we're looking at a scrubber installation on the fleet. And from EPA data, we know that 80% of the fleet that's over 50 years old does not have scrubbers installed, and 40% of the fleet that's between 41 and 50 years old also doesn't have these scrubbers installed. In addition to this pollution control that's lacking, we know that more than half of the fleet lacks NOx pollution controls. Nearly 80% have no controls for particulate matter or have outdated methods for controlling for that. And only 8% of coal generators have adequate mercury controls. So on this slide here, what we're showing is essentially data around the already announced retirements of the coal fleet. As you're well aware, there's been a significant uptick in these retirements over the last few years. And on this map, essentially, we're seeing those retirements. The red dots are the retirements, and the green dots are the rest of the operational fleet. And you can see that they're concentrated in the Midwest, in the Southeast, and that's where essentially we have a lot of these old, uncontrolled coal-fired power plants. From 2009 through May 2012, which is when we closed our data set, 288 coal generators in 34 states announced plans to retire or convert to natural gas, and this totaled 41 gigawatts of capacity, so about 12% of the U.S. Coal capacity. And as I pointed out before, there's a lot of correlation between the age of the fleet, whether they have controls installed, and another important factor is how much they're being used. So this chart basically shows the capacity factor of these plants, and we can see that a number of the plants that were announced for retirement are run at a significantly lower capacity than the rest of the fleet, so 44% versus 64% of the rest of the coal fleet. Now, we looked at all this data, and we essentially used it to inform our methodology of how we went about analyzing the rest of the operational fleet. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this chart because it sort of explains some of the core intuition that we developed as we went into this analysis. And Steve Klemmer is later on going to show a similar chart that looks at our operational fleet. Now, on this graph, what we're looking at is basically data points of the already announced retirements, so that 41 gigawatts that I talked about earlier. And what we did was we took those plants, took their operating costs, and added on the cost of pollution control equipment where it was lacking. And essentially, we were looking at four important pollution controls, controls for SOx, NOx, PM, and mercury. And the black dots that you see now are basically those operating costs with pollution control costs added in. And then we compared that to the cost of an existing NGCC plant, and that's the red line that you see there. And what we found was from the plants that have already announced their retirements, Most of them, their costs, once you add in pollution controls, lie above the cost of an existing NGCC plant. So all those black dots that are above that red line. And we can see that, as we said earlier, a number of them are being run at very low capacity factors, you know, less than 50% in many cases. And the few plants that look like they're cost competitive with existing NGCC plants tend to be the ones on the bottom right there that are being run at very high capacity factors. So this gave us some very important intuition about what might be driving some of these retirements, and we used that as we went about doing our analysis. And I'll talk you through a little bit of that next. So what about the rest of the operational coal fleet? And the first thing I'm going to do is sort of get to the meat of it and give you a sneak preview of our results, but then I'm going to walk you through our methodology in detail to tell you how we got there. So on this next slide, this is just our main findings, just a snapshot of our main findings, and you can see that we found that up to 59 gigawatts, in addition to the already announced retirements, the 41 gigawatts, are candidates for closure. Now, note, we use our language very carefully in the report. We're not literally calling for every one of these generators to be retired. What we are saying, though, is that these are generators that are vulnerable and that should be, as utilities and Wall Street investors and regulators are making decisions about whether to retrofit them, they need to reexamine the economics, the financial sense of doing so versus switching to cleaner alternatives. And in our report, we also point out that all over the country, there are readily available alternatives, cleaner alternatives such as natural gas, renewables, and efficiencies, and efficiency resources, and that they're available in ample quantities that they can step up to meet the gap as coal is retired. And essentially, when you look at that 59 gigawatts number, that's about 6.3% of the electricity used in 2009. And combined with the already announced retirements, we're talking about 10% of the total electricity used in 2009. And this is within the range of several other studies that have been out there, but we'll talk to you about what's unique about our analysis in a little bit. So here's just a snapshot of our methodology, and it's very simple. It's a straight-up economic test. What we did was we looked at the coal generators. We looked at their base running costs. Then we looked at whether they had any of these critical pollution controls that I described. For SOx, we were looking for scrubbers. For NOx, we were looking for SCR with over 90% capture. For particulate matter, we were looking for baghouses with 99% capture. And for mercury, we were looking at activated carbon injection, or ACI, with up to 90% removal when combined with the baghouses. So we checked to see if they had those, and if they didn't, we added them on and added the cost of doing so. And then we compared the cost of the coal generator that's now controlled with other sources. And we made comparisons with existing natural gas combined cycle plants, new natural gas combined cycle plants, and new wind projects. And the reason we did this is that these are some of the most widely available alternatives out there. And when we made the comparison, of course, we were very careful to make sure that we were including capital costs if it was a new NGCC plant or a wind project, but that we weren't if they were existing coal or NGCC plants, because, of course, if they were existing, those capital costs are sunk costs and they're not relevant for the retire-retrofit decision. Finally, we also did a sensitivity analysis where we looked at the impact of different natural gas prices. For our base case, we essentially used EIA's AEO 2012 natural gas price, and then we did a sensitivity with a 25% increase and a 25% decrease around that. We also looked at wind with and without the PTC extension, and finally we did a sensitivity looking at a carbon price and the impact that that would have. So I'm going to walk you through just a hypothetical illustration of our economic test just to make it more clear. This is hypothetical data. It's just an example. And what you see here in this chart is basically the alternatives that we compared, coal with existing new natural gas and wind. And we start out with a situation here comparing their operating costs. As I pointed out, for new NGCC and wind, we included a 20-year levelized capital cost. So So now what we do is we check for pollution controls. This particular coal generator was lacking some of those pollution controls, so we added them on, and that gives you that little red bar there on the coal generator stack. And then we created a high and low estimate to bound our range of what we called our ripe for retirement generators. And that high and low estimate were bounded by a comparison with existing NGCC and new NGCC plants. And in this case, we see when we make this comparison that this particular coal generator becomes more expensive than an existing NGCC plant, but it's still less expensive than a new NGCC plant. So it would meet our high estimate, the high end of our estimate for ripe for retirement, but not the low end of our estimate. Now, this is an example of our sensitivity, adding in a carbon price. As you can see, coal being the most fossil intensive, it has the biggest impact on the cost of coal there on the left, and it has an impact but a smaller one on natural gas, which has a lower embodied carbon content. Now in this case, you can see that the cost of our coal generator has now increased to the point that it's more expensive than all of the alternatives compared with existing NGCC, new NGCC, and wind. So now, before I turn this over to Steve, I just wanted to point out that what our analysis did and what it didn't do. So it was just looking at these four pollution controls and considering the cost of adding them on to modernize our coal fleet. These are widely available technologies. They're being used on our best performing plants, and we felt that this was a good proxy for looking at what it would take to modernize the fleet. But this is in no way an evaluation of compliance with EPA regulations. There are several Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act regulations that you're all aware of coming down the pike. This is not an analysis of compliance with those. We also didn't look at localized conditions that might make a certain plant either very vital to the electricity system for reliability reasons, because of transmission constraints or other sorts of local factors. So we didn't take those kinds of things into account. The other important thing to realize is that just because a particular generator passes our simple economic test doesn't necessarily mean there may not be other reasons why it should be considered for closure. For example, if you looked at cooling water or coal ash related costs of those plants. So it's important to know what we did and what we didn't do, but what we believe we've done in this analysis is provide a very good broad perspective, a nationally relevant perspective on the state of our coal fleet as it is right now and what part of it might be vulnerable for closure. At this point, I'm going to turn this over to Steve Klemmer so he can give us a deep dive analysis of the rest of our results.
Thanks, Rachel, and good morning to everyone on the call. Let me get the show on my screen. Can everyone see that? I hope. Yeah, so this particular chart is a scatter plot that shows the operating costs of coal generators that we deem ripe for retirement under our low and high estimates, as Rachel just described. Each of the black dots on this graph represent the operating costs of a coal generator in dollars per megawatt hour, including the cost of pollution control equipment as a function of its 2009 capacity factor. The blue line reflects the operating cost of a new natural gas combined cycle facility at different capacity factors. The 153 coal generators that are above that line are ripe for retirement under our low estimate. And the red line represents the operating cost of an average existing natural gas combined cycle facility at different capacity factors. And the 353 coal generators that are above that line are ripe for retirement under our high estimate. Many of the coal generators identified as ripe for retirements are underperformers that produce electricity at capacity factors well below the 2009 average of 64%. The 353 generators in our high estimate have a lot in common with each other and with the 288 generators that have already been announced for closure. For example, they're old, averaging 45 years of age with an average online date of 1967. They're largely underutilized with an average capacity factor of 47% compared with the 64% for the entire U.S. coal fleet. And there's really several plausible explanations for this, but among them is that because they are less efficient and more costly, they typically do not get dispatched as much as other plants. They're also some of the dirtiest generators in the country, with 71% lacking strong controls for three or more of the pollutants that we analyzed. Here we see a map of the 350 coal generators in 31 states from our high estimate. These units total 59 gigawatts of capacity, or 18% of the total coal fleet capacity, and these generators produced just over 6% of the total electricity used in the country in 2009. As you can see from the map, most of these units are concentrated in the Midwest, the Mid-Atlantic, and the Southeast, where most of the nation's coal capacity is located. And notably, 121 of these generators, or about a third of the national total, are located in the Southeast, and about 30 gigawatts of capacity, which is more than half of what we identified nationally under our high estimate. Having a little bit of trouble advancing the screen. It looks like it froze up. Ula or anyone else on the call, do you know what's going on?
Steve, do you want to click your mouse pointer once on the screen and then try the arrow?
Okay.
We could also go back to Rachel if that's helpful.
I think it worked. It seems like it advanced. Can everyone see the next slide now?
Yep.
Okay. So in the report, we ranked the states according to the amount of coal capacity they have, which may be ripe for closure. Under our high estimate, there were 19 states with more than 1,000 megawatts of ripe retirement capacity, and all of those most of those were located in the eastern half of the United States. The top five states the top four states were in the Southeast: Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and Florida. And Michigan was also in the top five. The Southeast also had eight states in the top 20. And Georgia led the country with more than 7,400 megawatts of ripe retirement capacity. When you include the 41 gigawatts of already scheduled retirements and you add those to our list, we arrived at a total of 641 generators with a total capacity of 100 gigawatts of retirements. This is about a third of the U.S. coal fleet and represented about 10% of the nation's total electricity use in the year 2009. 39 states have coal generators that fall into either of these categories, with 18 states having more than 2,000 megawatts of generating capacity represented. Our top five states changed somewhat in this case, with Ohio leading all the states at nearly 9,000 megawatts, followed by Georgia with 8,700, and then Alabama, Pennsylvania, North Carolina. Once again, the Southeast has five states that are in the top 10, Georgia, Alabama, North Carolina, Florida, and South Carolina, and eight that are in the top 20. The power companies in these states, in particularly states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina, which have more announced retirements, have already begun to make decisions that it is better to retire these units rather than retrofit their oldest and dirtiest coal generators. Of course, the states don't own coal generators. Power companies do. And we found that some of the nation's largest power companies have the most capacity identified as economically vulnerable under our analysis, with the top five being Southern Company, TVA, Duke, AEP, and First Energy. I should also point out that TVA, Duke, and AEP and First Energy have all made significant progress in determining a large number of generators that are ready for closure and have thus scheduled their retirement. Southern Company has shifted some generation from coal to gas in responding to the availability of low-cost natural gas over the past few years, so they're running some of their coal plants less and some gas plants more. they also recently announced the retirement of two generators and are starting to make some progress in ramping up energy efficiency investments. However, the company has also not shared the specifics of their plan for its remaining coal fleet, and given the large number of economically vulnerable coal units we identified, they'll need to work with utility regulators to carefully consider whether ratepayers would be better off by retiring these old facilities and boosting electricity generation from natural gas and renewable energy sources like wind instead of retrofitting them. As Rachel mentioned, we conducted sensitivity analysis to look at the coal retirements under several different scenarios and assumptions. Our analysis revealed that low natural gas prices and a price on carbon dioxide have the greatest impact in expanding the pool of coal-fired generators that are ripe for retirement. Extending the federal tax credits for wind power can also have a significant impact. So if you look on the left side of the screen, that shows the range under our core analysis that we've already discussed, the 16 to 59 gigawatts, that assumed natural gas prices of over a 20-year period of $4.88 per million BTU based on EIA projections. Under a scenario where natural gas prices are 25% higher, the range is a bit lower at 6 to 35 gigawatts. Under a scenario where natural gas prices are 25% lower, the range expands greatly to 36 to 138 gigawatts. I'll skip over the other. You can see the numbers on the slide there, but the carbon price also has a big impact, as I mentioned earlier. And extending the PTC, which is relative to that high estimate, would result in about 63 gigawatts of retirement related to wind. So at this point, you may be asking, how can we achieve these levels of coal retirement and still keep the lights on? Well, we believe the answer to this is yes, if proper planning is done. I just want to be upfront that we did not do a reliability analysis for this report that utilities would be required to do, but we did find that every region of the country has significant excess capacity available on their system or generation from cleaner, more affordable sources to effectively replace the 100 gigawatts of announced retirements and the ripe for retirement generators under our high case. The coal generators that are currently slated for retirement plus those identified as ripe for retirement can be shut down with minimal risk to regional electricity reserve margins. The data in this graph is based on information from the North American Electricity Reliability Council. Now, as the chart shows, in every region of the country except the Southeast, the projected excess capacity for the year 2014, as represented in the green bars, exceeds the combined capacity of coal plants that could be retired. At the national level, NERC projects that the U.S. will have a total of 145 gigawatts of excess capacity by 2014. In the Southeast, as represented by the CERC region, there is 30 gigawatts of excess capacity there, which is slightly below what we analyzed in terms of the combined announced and ripe retirement estimates. State policies are also driving significant new renewable energy development and reductions in electricity use in homes and businesses that could play a significant role in replacing coal plants. State renewable electricity standards have been adopted in 29 states and the District of Columbia, with 17 states setting targets of 20% or more. An additional 8 states have adopted voluntary, non-binding renewable energy goals. And energy efficiency resource standards that require utilities to meet a growing percentage of their customers' needs by investing in energy-saving technologies. 24 states have adopted those or similar policies, and 3 states have voluntary efficiency goals. And as you can see, notably, the Southeast is lacking many of these policies that some of the rest of the country has adopted, which is probably not too surprising to you, folks on this call. The So we looked at this at a regional level, similar to how we looked at the excess capacity, and by the year 2020, we project that existing state renewables and efficiency policies will generate or save more electricity than would be lost through the closure of the retired coal generators. And these clean energy gains would exceed the amount of power generated in 2009 by the coal units in most regions of the country, with the exception, again, of the Southeast, as shown in this chart. And the state efficiency and renewable standards are represented by the green bars on top. The gray bar represents the potential to ramp up generation from existing natural gas combined cycle plants. While the Southeast has less renewables and efficiency coming on from existing policies, that doesn't mean they don't have significant potential to actually use those resources to replace coal plants. So this is really a conservative estimate. In the report, we document several studies that have been completed by SACE, Navigant, Duke University, Georgia Institute of Technology, ACEEE, and others that demonstrate this significant potential in the Southeast from these resources. But without that, the Southeast certainly has significant potential to ramp up existing natural gas plants to help when combined with those other resources to replace the retired coal plants. On average, at the national level, the 220 gigawatts of existing natural gas power plants in the country operated at just 39% of their design capacity. And what we reflect in this chart is an assumption that plants could operate at 85%, which is really sort of an upper maximum. That's unlikely to happen, but they do have the potential to do that. So, and there's several other studies by MIT, Congressional Research Service, and others have used similar assumptions. And then not reflected in this chart is that new natural gas power plants could take us even further. Through 2017, NERC estimated that there's about 42 gigawatts of new natural gas capacity that's in planning or construction that would come online. So with a combination of these resources, we believe there is sufficient generation to replace the old coal plants that are included in our list for retirement. You know, the gas certainly plays a big role in our analysis, but we also highlight the fact that there's considerable risk of an over-reliance on natural gas. So currently, while there's considerable excess capacity, natural gas prices are at historic lows. Natural gas also offers a benefit in providing some operational flexibility to the grid that coal plants don't really provide, and can also help integrate renewable energy sources. However, an over-reliance on natural gas, as we've seen in the past decade, can lead to significant price volatility, particularly as we ramp up demand from natural gas, as Rachel showed in that first slide, which has been going on all over the country. There's also significant environmental concerns related to water quality issues and chemicals that are used in fracking. Natural gas is still a fossil fuel that produces greenhouse gas emissions, and to achieve deep cuts in greenhouse gas emissions that are needed to avoid dangerous climate change, we have to switch to other sources besides natural gas. And there's also an issue about building and ramping up significantly natural gas generation and competing with renewable energy and locking it out of the market by building even more excess capacity into the system. In our report, we also analyzed the CO2 emission reductions from these retirements, and this shows that the range, if you look over to the right under our combined total of the right for retirements and announced retirements, ranges from 245 to 410 million tons of CO2, depending on what is used to replace the coal plants. And the 410 represents about a 16% reduction in CO2 emissions from the coal fleet. So finally, I'd like to wrap up just by talking about a few of the recommendations from our report. One of the key recommendations was for regulators, investors, and utilities to really consider and rethink investing in costly retrofits to coal plants and to consider investing in cleaner, more affordable alternatives before that decision is made, and to really do a thorough assessment of that. One of the ways that can be done is by integrated resource planning, and several improvements, particularly in the Southeast, are needed on that level, both by regional grid operators and by utilities. In particular, related to that is FERC Order 1000 requires consideration of public policies, including EPA regulations, as well as renewables and efficiency policies. So it's really critical to ensure that the utilities and the regional grid operators are fully complying with that order and in their plans that they're submitting to FERC. Another important recommendation is to have strong regulations from EPA on power plant pollution standards, particularly for carbon dioxide emissions, and particularly to have strong regulations on existing plants especially for CO2, which, as we showed in our analysis, can make a huge difference. And it's really important to help diversify our mix away from natural gas, to also have strong state and federal clean energy policies, in particular extending the federal production tax credit for wind power, which is currently set to expire at the end of this year, is very important to continue the progress that's being made in the wind industry. We also, as we talked about state efficiency and renewables policies, there's a need to continue to strengthen them and to actually try to adopt those at the federal level. And finally, at some point, we really need to have a price on carbon emissions at the federal level to drive the changes in our generation mix and clean up the electricity mix. So I'm going to leave it there and pass it back over to Ula, and we'd be happy to take any questions that you have on the report.
Great. Thank you, Steve. We are going to open it up for question and answer now, and folks can chat in their questions into the dashboard, into the question section, and you can also raise your hand and we'll unmute your line. Right now, we do have one question from Eton. Is the 2009 capacity factor a strong estimate for average long-term capacity factor?
Could you repeat the first part of that question, please?
Yeah, is the 2009 capacity factor a strong estimate for average long-term capacity factor?
Well, I think the answer to that is, clearly the capacity factor of individual generators and natural gas plants on average is going to change over time based on the relative cost of gas and coal. And certainly that's somewhat of a limitation of our analysis because we're only looking at a snapshot in time. So that's definitely a consideration that would go into determining, the potential for ramping up gas plants. Of course, we've already seen that happening in the market where, as Rachel showed in that first slide, there's already been a switch in the dispatch away from coal to gas and the announced retirements that we showed in our analysis. So that certainly, the capacity factor from gas plants have increased since we did our analysis from the data that we used in 2009.
So just to follow up on that a little bit, so this is, of course, generator specific. It's also interesting to look at it across different resources. So, for example, we pointed out the low capacity factors of some of these old uncontrolled coal-fired power plants. And that's actually something that has been, these are old plants. They're technically, coal is seen as sort of a quote-unquote baseload resource that these plants, you know, the understanding is that they run all the time except when they're pulled out for maintenance. But when you look at these old plants, you see that actually they're not being run very much. So it's sort of instructive to look at that part of the coal fleet. And that I do think is a long-term trend, you know, that those plants are so expensive to run that they're only going to be pulled in at very, very high demand points, and their capacity factors are almost permanently now damped out. Around the natural gas fleet, as Steve pointed out, there's a significant slack there in the existing natural gas fleet that could technically be ramped up. Now, ramping it up obviously also means pulling in more natural gas. So you will need to get to the really high levels, for example, the 85% that we pointed out, you'd need some more pipeline infrastructure in certain parts of the country to pull in that level of natural gas. But it's clearly there. It is a technical potential that's there.
Steve, this is Eitan. My question I was trying to get at was, is it possible, or did you look at the sensitivity of what using just 1 year's estimate for capacity factor, if that's a good long-term estimate for how much these units are active, so you get the cost estimates right? Because I'm just curious, you know, if you looked at whether that was a good average estimate or, you know, whether that wasn't in the scope of what you did.
Well, I think it's a little bit outside of the scope of what we did. I mean, the tricky part there is if you look back even, you know, 4 or 5 years when natural gas prices were spiking, the capacity factors are considerably different than the environment that we're in right now. And going forward, you know, it depends on what you believe is going to happen to natural gas prices. Our analysis uses EIA's projections, which have kind of a steady increase in natural gas prices, but don't have any of those spikes that we've seen in the past. So I think it's really tough to come up with kind of a long-term average for gas. And, you know, we did look at a couple of different years, and we also looked at very specific data from the entire U.S. fleet of natural gas combined cycle plants to figure out what we showed in that graph as the potential at the regional level. So that chart, you know, the average I said was, I think, 39% for the fleet, but there's some variation in the averages at the regional level depending on how gas and coal plants are being dispatched.
Thanks.
Uh-huh.
We actually don't have any other questions right now in the queue. If folks do want to ask a question, we can unmute your line, but we need your hand raised or question chatted in. Amelia, we are unmuting your line.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hey, there was a slide a while back that showed low and high estimates for different alternative scenarios, and then on the right-hand side it showed wind. And I just wondered if you could go back to that slide. Yeah, this one. And I didn't quite understand how wind fit into this picture.
Sure. So basically what we did was we looked at the cost of an average wind facility in the U.S. with and without the production tax credit. So at the low cost end, or what would be shown up, which would show up as the high capacity or the high point of this graph in the capacity, is an assumption that wind costs $50 per megawatt hour. Without the production tax credits, about $70 per megawatt hour on average, and that assumes a 35% capacity factor. So there's clearly, you know, this is an average again, there's clearly a range for wind depending on what the resource is in different parts of the country. But that's how we did the analysis, and I guess the other thing to just keep in mind is that it's, you know, unlike a gas or a coal plant, wind projects can't be dispatched. So it's a little bit different dynamic, which is why we didn't show that in the scatter plot. But that said, wind power has very low operating costs. So once the wind projects are built and operating, the grid operators will normally take that power because it's one of the cheapest sources of electricity. So whenever it's available, it comes in and it essentially displaces something that's the highest cost generating source on the grid at that time. So it is a little bit different dynamic in terms of the analytic piece of this versus how the actual dispatch works in reality. Does that help, or do you have any other questions about that?
Well, I think maybe I'm not totally absorbing what this graph is saying. Is this showing different ways, going back to your scatter plot with the two lines for high and low estimates? Yeah, that one. Is that bar chart we were just looking at showing where these blue and red lines might move to in different future scenarios that you considered?
Right. Okay, let me try to explain that. So if you were to take those costs of wind that I just said of $50 to $70 per megawatt hour and sort of put it into this graph, that range, black dots that would be above those lines would be reflected in that that other chart that we just showed you.
So it's basically a way to compare the costs of these plants compared to wind, as well as comparing it to natural gas.
Right. And the reason why we didn't put on this graph is because, once again, you know, there is a range of capacity factors for wind projects, but they can't be dispatched like a coal or a gas plant can be dispatched at different levels. So that's why we didn't put it on here. But effectively, if you were to draw those lines in there for wind at $50 and $70 per megawatt hour, that would show what that previous chart of what the range of retirements would be. The other scenario that we did with high and low gas prices and CO2 costs, how those would affect this chart is, obviously a higher or lower gas price would shift those red and blue curves either up or down, depending on the gas price. And CO2 prices would also shift both of the gas curves up, but it would also shift all those black dots up to an even greater extent because of the higher carbon content of coal. Does that help explain how those scenarios work?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have another question that's been chatted in here from Rhonda. Would you please discuss this in light of the NCAR report last year that gas does not get us much farther with climate moderation? Rhonda, we can unmute you as well if you want to elaborate further on your question.
I think the NCAR report, if it's the one that I'm thinking about, which basically showed that natural gas was not a long-term solution for addressing climate change, we would, I tried to touch on that in that one of those last slides I showed you. We do agree with that. We have concerns about that in terms of too large of a shift to gas, even though at the smokestack, gas has CO2 emissions that are about 50 to 60% lower than in typical coal plant. So you do get some emission reductions there. There's the issue of methane leakage from fracking, from the distribution of gas in pipelines, that with methane being a much more potent greenhouse gas than CO2, that it can eliminate much of the benefits of natural gas from a CO2 perspective. So switching over just from coal to gas and at the same time trying to reduce emissions on the order of 80% by 2050 in the U.S., you can't get there by if you switch too far over to gas.
Angela. Okay, I think that's it for all of our questions. Thank you, Steve and Rachel, so much, and everybody for attending today. We did record this presentation, so we will have the audio recorded. And Steve, if you want to chime in here, you did mention that you will have a PDF of the presentation available as well.
Sure.
Okay, yeah, thank great. You everyone for joining us today. It was wonderful to present this information to you. We'll send around a PDF of the slides as well. If you'd like to follow up with any of the report authors, all our contact information is available online with the report. So please feel free to follow up with questions.
Okay,
and
great.
Thank you so much, folks at SAFE, Ula and Erin and others for hosting us today. It was really a very nice chance to talk with folks in the southeast of the country.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Rachel and Steve. And don't forget to check our website for all the other resources, blog, and access to the report and whatnot. Thanks, everyone, for your time.